Okay, I was wondering if you could start by talking about your childhood and your education and how you were involved with music as a child.
I grew up in a very small town, and I started piano, I think, in grade 2. A teacher came to my parents and thought I would do well taking piano, so I studied piano in elementary school by taking piano lessons during the recess hour with a teacher who was, you know, in the school but only did private piano lessons. So I continued doing piano lessons through elementary, junior high changed teachers, and through high school the same teacher.
Okay.
And then I was also part of the choir in high school and was the accompanist for the top choir. So I sang and or accompanied for the high school choir, which is quite a well-known choir.
Okay. Is this Brainerd?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. What influenced your decision to become an academician, and who influenced your decision?
I was involved with music, you know, throughout high school, and then I just thought, well, I would study music in college. I don't think it was anybody specific. I've been taking piano all along, so I just wanted to continue that.
Okay. Can you talk about your college music education and maybe how it was different or similar to what goes on here today in Madison at the School of Music?
Okay, and again, I was at a small college, and it was a BA in music. So primarily you had liberal arts, full, complete Bachelor of Arts education in the sense of the non-music courses. And so therefore, at the same time, there were almost the same equivalent of the number of credits for a Bachelor of Music as here. But that was too many credits. So they wouldn't give you credits for some subjects that you had to take. And I'm not saying that, I'll give you an example, but let's say that first year theory would automatically put your music requirements over the level for a major. So you would have to take first year theory without credit. Because you couldn't get into second year theory. Let's say that they said you had to have 6 credits of theory.
Uh-huh.
But that meant 6 credits of theory for 2 complete years. But that would be too many credits on the major side.
Okay.
So you had to take courses without credit.
Okay, and then you also had like music history. And
music history, music literature.
Performance
music
courses.
Education, yeah. Piano. I did also organ 1 year.
What about ethno courses? Did you have any exposure to ethnomusicology there? When did you first kind of arrive at ethnomusicology?
Well, that was quite by accident because I didn't know it existed. People didn't talk about it, that there was such a field. And I think that one day the Harvard Dictionary of Music was open. There was an article called Comparative Musicology. It was also about that time that I was thinking about going to graduate school. And so there was this field called comparative musicology. And since it wasn't a signed article, then it was an article written by Billy Opel. So what I did was write a letter to him. And I don't know, very soon after that, I received this letter from him saying that he was retired 15 years from Indiana, but my letter did find him someplace in Cornell University or Ithaca, New York, or something like that. And he said that there were no degree programs at that time in this field, which is now called ethnomusicology, except for UCLA. Other courses were provided at universities in anthropology departments or linguistic departments. So it was almost as if music departments say, well, you know, if you want to study music, come and study the music that we teach. But we don't call that music, you know, you have to go over to anthropology or to linguistics in that particular case. I also applied to Indiana because there were courses being taught there. I'm not sure of folklore at that time, but for sure anthropology. And I think I also applied to Columbia University. There was a well-known scholar there at that time by the name of Kurt Zox. And I didn't remember it at the time, but I one time, I don't know, about 10 years ago, came across those letters saying, gee, I almost had that opportunity to study with Kurt Zox. But then when I saw his death date, it turned out to be that I would have perhaps been able to study with him 1 year, and then he did die. So, So purely by accident, I got a scholarship to UCLA as a teaching assistant.
Okay, and that was the only ethnomusicology program in the country at the time?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. How did you fund your graduate school?
I had a teaching assistantship.
And what about undergraduates?
Undergraduate, my parents paid, except I paid all my books, all my piano lessons, all my living expenses, from babysitting money and paper routes and good things like that.
Same things we do today.
That's right.
What made you decide to go to Africa?
Well, I guess I was all set to go to Japan. I thought, you know, pick some area. And one time the wife of my professor said, well, you know, have you got a particular area? And I said, well, Japan. And she said, well, why don't you do Africa? Nobody's doing Africa. At that time, I was the only female in classes in ethno, and all the men used to worry about me, whether I would go native or, you know, couldn't I find a better place to go. But I stuck with my choice of Africa. I mean, I decided to do Africa at that time, and then started language courses, Swahili, and then I did Luganda. And then my Swahili, who was also the Luganda instructor, had spent 25 years in Uganda. So he asked me why I wasn't going to go to Uganda, because I had chosen a topic in Tanzania or Kenya.
Okay. What brought you to the University of Wisconsin in 1968?
I was at the end of doing research in Uganda, and a professor came up to me and asked me, said that University of Wisconsin was interested in hiring somebody to do ethnomusicology, and African studies would be willing to provide partial funding of the salary. And I didn't think anything more of that, and then I came home Christmas 67, something like that, and then returned back to Los Angeles to start writing my dissertation. And my professor said, my mother called and said, there's a professor from the University of Wisconsin who called and said, don't take any jobs until we've talked to you. And so then I was called to come and, or, you know, to submit my materials and then come for an interview.
Okay. When you came here, obviously it was a time of great turmoil at the university. I wonder if you could talk a little bit about your experiences during the student uprisings of the late 60s.
Well, I wasn't here for the first one, the Dow Chemical one, which was the most dangerous or the most injuries as far as police. I think there was one policeman who was permanently injured by somebody hitting him with a book bag full of bricks or rocks or something. But I was here for the demonstration for the Afro-American Studies courses and program, and for the, what's that famous place over here? Mifflin Street.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
The Mifflin Uprising?
Yes. Which was just something about wanting to have a block party. During the Afro-American Studies, and then the post of Ohio, is Ohio State or Kent University, where was the student killed?
Kent State.
So after that there was another demonstration and police presence on campus.
What was the faculty response or the School of Music response? Were they involved? Were the
I don't know about that Dow Chemical one, but the other one, it was mostly the students communicating with administration, and the faculty were the last to know. So in the terms of the one for Black Studies, finally we were called or invited to attend, if we wanted to, a faculty meeting to see how this strike was affecting the faculty, as well as the students and the administration. But I did have the student who was the leader of the demonstrators, his wife was in my African music class, and I remember getting a call from somebody in the administration asking me about her, and I said, well, she's one of the top students in my class. Yes, she has missed a few classes. And I always wondered who that call was from and why they were calling me. Her husband was not as strong an academic as she was, and I don't know what has happened to them.
Hmm. Do you remember anything about the bombing of Stirling Hall?
Well, I was at home about 4.5 miles away, and I heard it. I happened to be up that late because I had friends in from out of town. I think it happened about 2:30 a.m., and I think I was just trying to fall asleep, but I could hear the sound. Also, the bankers were here on their traditional summer banking school course. They come here every summer. They were here at that time, and they also then set up a fund then immediately for the family of Fasnacht. And I didn't know until years later that the person who moved into my apartment above me, where I was living at that time, turned out to be the successor to Fasnacht.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
That's interesting.
And he has now, he was in the physics department, and then he left academia, and is now involved in ecumenical ministry in town. And I know his name, but I can't think of it right now, so maybe I'll think of it later.
Okay. In the research in our course, we've come across a couple periods where there seemed to be a lot of faculty turmoil. The death of Dale Gilbert stands out. And also, there was a musicology meeting that was supposed to take place here, and apparently prior to that, several musicology faculty members resigned.
I don't think anything to do with resignation and the invitation. I think the invitation was withdrawn. I think the invitation was extended by Ava Badura Skoda from the university, and I think she withdrew the invitation, but I'm not sure. I wasn't a member. I know that the invitation was withdrawn. The university withdrew the invitation to the American Musicological Society. And, of course, people have remembered that ever since. I wasn't a member of the executive committee. I don't know. You know, I don't really know all the details of the aftermath.
Okay. What about the Dale Gilbert situation?
Dale Gilbert's situation arose after a member of the faculty who was a visiting professor. I can't remember the rank, but the dean regularly will call to a department after somebody has had visiting status for a number of years and say, we think it's time for your department to finalize the decision. You know, this man has been here, this man or this woman has been here 3 years or 5 years, and we think your department should make a decision about whether to retain that person or not. And so the decision was made by the executive committee not to retain that person. And after that, I think the person, Professor Young, threatened a case. And Dale Gilbert was assured by the dean and the upper administration that he would be fully supported in any legal activities or any legal case brought by that professor. The university has a legal department to support the university in such cases. Unfortunately, as a chair of the department, which happens, you know, for any administrator, if they can't discuss it among their peers, it's very difficult. And I don't know whether people at the time knew that, you know, could foresee that anything like this would happen to Dale Gilbert. I myself was out of the country during that time.
Okay.
So I know that it happened at a time of final exams. Do you have the date of the? Do you have the date of his death?
I think it was 1980. The exact date, I don't know.
It's about 1983, I think.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Either 83 or 84.
Okay. So you were out of the country, kind of removed from the situation.
Yeah, I mean, at first I had letters saying that he had disappeared. and that, you know, there were efforts to find him, including a national search.
Can you talk a little bit about the changes you've observed here in the School of Music in general over the past 20 years or so?
There have been several changes, and one of the things that we used to be able to do is to look toward the future, seeing where the gaps were, what should be added, or what new subjects should we introduce in terms of the future. And that was also at a time when you could relatively well predict when retirements would take place. So if you knew that Professor so-and-so was coming up to their 65th birthday, or if that person might decide to retire at 70, and of course those things changed over the years. So when I first came here, people retired at 65. Then it went to 67, and then it went, could be anywhere from 65 to 70. Nowadays, there is no maximum age for retiring. So it's a little bit more difficult to predict right now, and you can't set priorities like you did in the past. So for instance, during one period, we decided that it would be good to introduce guitar if another opening occurred. And then that has to be balanced in terms of where are you going to put that new opening? How do you introduce a new opening? Or do you redefine the number of FTE, full-time equivalents? If you have 45 full-time faculty, one of them retire, then usually a new subject is going to come out of what we call one of those slots. So it would be very difficult to redefine, let's say, a flute slot. Instead of getting a flute teacher, we're going to bring in a guitar teacher. So usually it has to come from some other kind of slot. So that has to be taken into consideration. Another thing was a full-time saxophone player was added. We had a part-time saxophone when I first came. Same thing happened with string bass, that was a part-time. I think harp has remained a part-time. I was the first ethnomusicologist, and then you can check your facts and figures. Andy Sutton came about 1980, something like that, 80, 81. And he came partially to fill a musicologist's place. The musicologist was on leave. And so we suggested that why don't we have part-time ethno and part-time musicology. So Andy came and taught that one semester and taught a music history course and two ethno courses. Well, including the gamelan, because the gamelan was already here. Mm-hmm. And then people in the area liked his work. And then I think we either had a retirement, probably a retirement, and then we decided to advertise for somebody to do ethnomusicology and musicology. So Andy was chosen for the permanent position there. Other changes, we have music technology now, that's new. I'm just going through the different areas. Music education, we have somebody who's interested in non-Western cultures, Julie Koza in particular. We didn't have somebody whose load was, part of their load was collegium. So formerly, up to the time I think of Michael Long, people did that as an extra activity. So I believe Michael Long was the first one whose job description included collegium. We're going to start introducing specific courses in harpsichord next year. So that also is new. Women and music, that's a new field. So there have been a lot of changes.
What about among the students? How do you think students have changed? Students that you have in class, are they better, are they worse in general?
Oh, I think that's hard. You know, it depends on the group of students. It depends on the faculty members. It depends on the job situation. So, for instance, all of our PhDs in ethnomusicology have jobs at top-rated schools. And we've not been as lucky with our musicology graduate students. And there's been more change in the musicology program in terms of faculty. Mm-hmm. So, for instance, Larry Gushy left, and there were several students who left with him and then went to University of Illinois. Unfortunately, I don't know if any of those three or four students, for instance, ever finished their degrees.
Hmm. What was the state of ethnomusicology in the late 1960s? I know you talked about that a little bit. But...
Well, it was just a new field, at least as far as Wisconsin, certainly. The only other school, well, I mentioned already Indiana, having some people in the anthropology department, and then that later, in fact, with one of our graduates, Portia Maltsby, then she became part of the folklore department and black studies. And one of our master's candidates, Melanie Burnham, then went to Indiana to do her PhD, and she's also employed in folklore and black studies. In the meantime, Indiana had a couple of ethnomusicologists in the School of Music. George Herzog, was he an anthro? Well, anyway, Kaufman was in the music department. And he has retired since, and he's never been replaced. So I think at Indiana, they don't have anybody in the School of Music doing ethno. Michigan had already started ethno program with Bill Lam and then with Judith Becker. And I don't know at what time Minneapolis introduced their first ethnomusicologist.
Yeah, I'm not sure who their first was. I know Alan Kagan is still there now. I had a couple courses with him.
He may have been the first. And I think Iowa to this day doesn't have anybody.
Yeah, I don't think so.
Yeah.
How do you feel ethnomusicology has changed over the past, say, 25 years or so?
Oh, topics are different. There's currently gender is a topic in any discipline. So that, ethno has been right up there with the rest of the disciplines examining gender. There's been more emphasis now on popular culture, cassette culture, and more topics in the U.S. Just in the same, let's say with anthropology, in the past people would go to any place on the globe. Now, people are encouraged also to do studies in their own communities or someplace in the United States. That's also happening with ethno. There still is emphasis on those programs which include performance as part of training and those which have not and never have. A few have added that dimension to their program. At Wisconsin, we're lucky to have at least five federally funded area studies programs funded by the United States Office of Education. And with that, then we can ensure that students will get language training prior to doing field work, which is so essential. Mm-hmm. So University of Wisconsin is unique in that we can serve the needs of students from many areas of the world as far as giving them, pre-training. Other than that, even the South Asian program here, other ethnomusicologists have come, or students from any other discipline come because they know every summer at University of Wisconsin, major Indian languages are taught. So Telugu, Tamil for South India, Hindi for North India are taught regularly. So, for instance, I met a student, a doctoral student from University of Illinois who came and spent a summer here studying, it was either Telugu or Tamil before he did his research in India. And I remember people coming, I don't remember the disciplines, coming from Brown University. So that is a very old program and continues on today. Hmm.
Can you talk a little bit about your experience as a woman in your education or fieldwork or your career as a professor and researcher? And how your experience as a woman may have been different from that of a man or if you've ever experienced any discrimination or things like that?
Well, that's a huge topic. I find it very interesting. Today people use the term role model. You know, whether it's a black male or a white male or a man or let's say a woman. And I've asked some of my female colleagues, younger colleagues, and said, did you have a role model when you grew up or when you were in school? They said, no, we didn't have any. We weren't looking for them. So there's that whole dimension that has changed. People want role models, whereas people from my generation and younger generations didn't search out role models, and it didn't bother them, or they didn't think about them, because I guess nobody was talking about them. So I think with new topics, like you have gender studies, then you have these people who are looking to see what models existed, you know, whether it's pictorial, how was the woman portrayed, or whatever. And so that's a new thing that's happening. Female professors, I think, are... I don't know whether the students realize, but there's a different approach from the student's standpoint to the female professor or to the male professor. And there are studies that say that if the expectations in case of gender are not met, you know, the fit is not right, so that, for instance, if... A female professor is usually considered a warm person and does not have the same kind of characteristics as a male. So if the woman is not warm enough and gets too much into what they consider the male characteristics, then the woman is not evaluated in the same terms. There are these underlying assumptions. So that's different. Of course, there isn't representation, for instance, in the science departments as much as there are in the humanities, and that came from, in the past, people specifically saying they don't want female graduate students. So I know an age mate of mine who went to the same college as me, came here for her graduate studies, and she was teased throughout her career here by her fellow colleagues saying, you know, you're a scientist. You know, you're a female. You shouldn't be wearing shoes like that. Meaning you should be wearing those old clunky, old maid shoes that they associated the traditional female with. And that same person hearing stories from professors saying, last year we admitted one female student, and that female student came and got pregnant in her first semester and dropped out of school. You know, i.e. all female students are going to get pregnant and drop out of the program, why should we deal with them? Mm-hmm. And today she's a very top professional academic, although in her particular university she's never been invited to be head of her department, whereas she's regularly gotten NIH grants to the tune of $1 and $2 million every single year of her career. But she's within a science department. Mm. This department, we've had one female head of department, and it's also interesting that some people, after she left, have said, I will not vote for another female for a good long time. So in terms of one female head of department at this university for the School of Music, then for some people, I'm not saying this, you know, that's for many people, but for some people, that one woman became the signal or the symbol for all females. That whatever that person did as an individual person, that all females would follow the same suit. So that's very interesting.
Yeah, it is. You mentioned that you were the only female graduate student in your classes at UCLA. Did you experience any of the discrimination that your colleague in the sciences did, or was that an awkward situation?
No, just in the sense that I've mentioned before, that they didn't like the idea that I had chosen Africa.
So they were worried about what was going to happen to you there?
That's right. But I did have to... Our seminars usually began with a discussion of pipes and tobaccos and, you know, what kind of tobacco are you smoking today, you know, and then they would pass around the tobacco pouch or whatever, and where'd you buy that, and what kind of a mixture is that? And,
really?
Yes.
Huh.
So it was a time, you know, meerschaum pipes, the white pipes, were a sign of prestige or status or, you know, good pipes. And so many of the students were into that. Not all of them. Doing field work, I guess that I didn't have any difficulties in Africa. I never thought about it. Didn't give me any problems. Where I realized that I had some advantage was in Morocco, which is a Muslim country. So males are separate, females are separate. And as a female foreigner, you had access to both communities. So you were treated as the visitor and were received by the male part of society. At the same time, you had access to the female part of society. Whereas a male researcher in the same position wouldn't have access to both genders.
Yeah. That's interesting. I guess I have just a couple more questions here. What do you view as the two or three most important musical events to occur in Madison since you've been here? The things that really stick out in your mind?
Oh, I could say a couple, two, three different things. We used to have wonderful programs and just very contemporary things. We had a particular choral director, assistant choral director called Vance George, who was very imaginative. I mean, Ludoslavsky's things would be 1 month off the pen or onto the page or whatever, and they'd be performed in Music Hall, which was our big concert hall at that time. And faculty performers were people like Larry Gushy. Marion Gushy also was active at that time. And very wonderful graphics on our posters and those kinds of things. People were in residence that we haven't had that kind of stature of person for a long, long time. More recently, I think like the Frank Lloyd Wright opera was outstanding. And I think that was a special event in Madison. Sometimes I've thought, I wish we could name the best performance, let's say, from in the School of Music for this year.
Mm-hmm.
Because things like when Ellsworth Snyder taught a seminar in musicology and did, I think he was doing Cage's music primarily, but at least it was a 20th century topic. And then the seminar students performed over in Music Hall. And it was very interesting because you had Cage's work. I think you had Morton Feldman being performed, and you had Ellsworth Snyder would come out and do the pass out the soda straws and have everybody, you know, bend them in order to make noise, and Ellsworth giving marvelous lectures. I remember a young musicology student dressed in her strapless formal. I can't remember which piece she performed in, but it was so out of character for this wonderful musicology student. It was just one of those outstanding events of the year. I was going to mention a third thing, but maybe it'll come to me in a minute.
Okay. What do you feel are the most important issues regarding music education for the future?
Well, I think, I mean, it's the last phrase that's important, for the future. And sometimes I think we don't take the time to look far enough into the future to see where we are all going.
Mm-hmm.
And what new things are out there that we have to start learning about, because we train people who then train students at all levels from kindergarten up through university. So, for instance, we have this Madison Plan 2000, right here in the Madison School District. And I'm not sure if there's any music hooked up in with regard to that. I know that one of the parts of that plan is that every student shall study Spanish. And I think this is beginning with the junior high, and I'm not sure for how long. I do know that at the present, in junior high, students get 6 weeks of German, 6 weeks of French, and 6 weeks of Spanish. But now with this plan, they want at least one full year of Spanish. I don't see the same thing happening in music. We have a big continent to the south of us, and I find that we turn our backs to them and do not acknowledge them.
Mm-hmm.
in terms of classical, in terms of folk, in terms of any kind of music. And they have, if you study their histories, they have thousands of years of civilization, you know. And classical compositions, you know, I don't know how far back, but just as, I think, even earlier than what was going on in what we know as the United States today. So, I mean, although there are some musicologists who are working in this field, that is kind of a newish field. And I don't think we're paying enough attention. And just to look at what the young population is now today. I know that in California, for instance, at Berkeley, was it last year that their freshman class, for the first time, whites were not in the majority in their freshman class at the university. So the demographics of our country are changing, and I don't know if we're taking this, I know we're not taking this into account for the future.
Mm-hmm. What's your current role as a performer of music?
My current role? Well, I still am an active member of Javanese Gamelan, have been for ever since we've gotten those instruments here. And I teach Uganda xylophone. And sometimes I play when I teach it. Mm-hmm. But I don't, you know, the students give the public performances.
Do you still play the piano at all, or sing, or participate in any of those things?
I sing in congregational church, you know, singing. But I'm not a member of choir, or don't play the piano much anymore. But that has to change. I bought a piano, so.
Now you have to play.
That's right. Wasn't when
this wheel was turning, but this one wasn't. Looks like we're going again here.
Good.
Okay, these last few questions are kind of real general. Just as interest, this is probably more of interest to me than maybe even the class, just because I've gotten to know you in several courses. But I was wondering, how do you spend your leisure time? What do you do outside of the university?
Oh, I like to go to auctions and garage sales. I like to do gardening, trim bushes.
Really?
Yeah, rake leaves. Mm-hmm.
That's interesting. What sort of general comments would you like to say about this school of music, or is there anything you'd like to comment on that I haven't asked you about in particular? Some thoughts about, you know, the university school of music and how it's run or how it prepares students.
Well, that's a big question too. We have degree programs in all of the major areas of music. So for instance, at the graduate level, we have not only degrees in music theory, musicology, ethnomusicology, music education, and applied degrees. And most of the same specialties at the master's level. Now, I'm not so sure that what we do have now, are all these little individual degrees at the undergraduate level.
You're not sure if that's a good thing?
Yes.
Or if it's necessary?
Yeah. Because we do have already a core set of courses. Mm-hmm. At the undergraduate level, everybody should take at least, I mean, I think in common to all, for instance, 3 years of theory and I think the minimum is 3 courses in music history. So that's common. And then, you know, an equal number of, let's say, applied. But then if you decide to do an undergraduate degree in, let's say, flute, string bass or something, what are you qualified to do at the end of your four years?
Yeah, very little.
Whereas my undergraduate and other people who have have Bachelor of Arts degrees, for instance. We have many liberal arts courses. We also have many music courses, which always had a solo performance requirement. I did music education. I did practice teaching. I gave recitals every year from freshman year on up. So that it's more intense program, yet it's more rounded program and includes elements from all, you know, the academic and the performance side and the organization side.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that sounds very much like the program at the University of Minnesota that I went through. It was a BA.
And then you have more options at the end. Mm-hmm. You can go and then concentrate at the graduate level on an instrument. You can concentrate on an academic course. Or you could concentrate on organizations in the guise of conducting. But each student has training at all those different levels. And each becomes more valuable. Each you know, is an equal part of it. I find that sometimes people who are in applied, for instance, never get to the library. And it's only in terms, really, of the music history courses that they have to go to the library to do, well, first of all, listening assignments or getting books off of the reserve shelf. Maybe they don't have to do, except for music history, they wouldn't have to do research outside of their own, outside of that course. Outside of music history, they don't go and do research in music theory, or they don't go do research on their instrument, which I think is too bad. Mm-hmm. Of course, you could say that probably for every other major too. You know, if the professor, instead of having a textbook, provides a compendium of articles, gets permission to have them copied by Kinko's or Bob's Copy Shop, then that student doesn't have to go to the library either. Except if there are term papers that are required. Mm-hmm. So I think the writing skills have changed. Going back to one of your other questions, students come in with less writing experience. Students come in with less foreign language experience. And so less foreign language experience at the graduate level. So then they have to do catch up. Mm-hmm. They've neither taken French, they've neither taken German. And then that course will not count as part of their course load for their degree requirements. So somehow we have to, but that's tied to the overall educational structure or makeup of any university. So I don't know when that foreign language requirement was dropped some time ago. And I think some schools are working to have it reintroduced. At least even here at the University of Wisconsin, when they talk about the credits, the types of courses that students have in order to qualify for entrance into the University of Wisconsin. In fact, that whole English requirement, they're going to have to start reintroducing writing courses here in the English department. Formerly, the English department said, well, we're not here to do remedial work. If your department requires it, it'll be up to your department to teach students how to write. And the students in non-English departments say, well, I'm not here to teach people how to write. I wasn't hired to do that. So that's being evaluated right now.
Mm. One question that just came to my mind is, how did you become involved with the New Grove Dictionary?
Oh, New Grove Dictionary, that's just like any other publication that's coming out. Somebody writes you a letter saying, we would like you to write an article on X. We'll give you so many words or whatever, do you accept?
So they requested you specifically because of your background with African music?
And then there were general area editors. So, so-and-so was head of Africa articles, so-and-so was head of South America, so-and-so was head of all the different world areas. And then I think then they in turn suggested to the main editor, Stanley Sadie, because I believe the original letter came from Stanley Sadie.
Mm.
So, and most people don't know, I mean, it was published in 1980, and it was due to be published in 1972. So if you look around and say, well, how come so-and-so is not, didn't write for the New Grove? Well, they were probably still in high school in 1972 when it was first predicted that it would be published.
Mm.
The one interesting thing is that I don't know about new editor, new participants, but all these spin-offs series from the New Groves, like the New Grove Dictionary of American Music, New Grove Dictionary of Musical Instruments, or whatever. Again, I was approached to do the xylophone one for that particular one. Some cases, I think what they asked people if they would like to update their article, and maybe people said no. So you have to, you can't just assume that the articles are going to be the same as in the original Grove. Some are completely expanded, and I know one of the big criticisms for the New Grove 1980 edition was the coverage of U.S. music was particularly poor. So I think that, you know, many of those subjects were added or updated or expanded in terms of that spin-off project.
What about your own research, or what do you see yourself doing in the next few years, say before you decide to leave the university? And
well, I've got a project that will start this summer, hopefully in Nigeria. So that would be an expansion into another part of Africa. And I'd like to do something in South America one of these days.
Is there anything else you'd like to say in general? Any other comments or questions you think that need to be addressed that I've missed along the way? Or?
One thing we didn't talk about is, you know, you asked what were the most exciting musical events. And one thing that I didn't have in my mind when you asked me that question, and I said, well, I couldn't think of the third thing, but now a fourth thing has entered my mind, is that there was a very spectacular opening for this School of Music. And the first concert here was a Javanese gamelan concert, which was the first time a gamelan was brought to Madison, I think, or at least had a public performance. But that was the opening concert in this building. And there were events, lectures, important artists that came throughout that opening. And so I think, you know, the opening events for the School of Music, the new building, were quite spectacular.
Yeah, they got some really impressive names to come here for that.
So, you know, that was barely my second semester here. And I'm sure they planned that for a long time. But there must be, you know, information about that as well as the plans for this whole building, the whole building process.
Okay. Well, that's about all the questions I have.
Well, you can just go over your material and see if there are gaps.
Okay.